Hi, I'm Fern Cusack, Senior Producer here at Promax BDA, and this is the Daily Brief Podcast. Never before have we seen so many brands stepping forward and taking strong stands on what is happening in the political and cultural landscape. As politics, public policy, and human rights take center stage, and as consumers passionately embrace deeply divided ideologies, brands have not only reacted to the social climate, but in many cases, they have also been cultural leaders in communicating their positions. What drives a brand to take a stand? And is its mission brand-based or just good business? During this year's conference, Katie Steinmetz, the San Francisco bureau chief at Time Magazine, moderates a discussion about brand stances on political and social issues. Here's what they had to say.
Hi, everyone. I'm here from Time Magazine. I'm the San Francisco bureau chief to moderate a panel called When Brands Take a Stand. And I'm going to start by introducing our panelists, an illustrious group. We've got Peter Benedek, the co-founder of United Talent Agency, one of the three largest talent agencies in the world. We've got... Welcome. We've got Rajiv Menon, the Director of Cultural Strategy for Civic Entertainment Group, an award-winning marketing services firm. We've got Brad Jenkins, the Managing Director of Funny or Die DC. And we've got Kim Burgess, the Director of Marketing and Producer for the hilarious Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. So I'm glad this panel wasn't earlier during Comey testimony, because no one would be here, I'm sure. But it's tense time. Politics is dividing a lot of people. It's dominating all of our conversations. On a lot of different levels, Americans are saying you have to choose a side. The being in the middle isn't sufficient anymore. But that calculus is obviously a lot different when you're an individual citizen versus a brand versus a company. We're here to talk about when brands do take a stand and what are the risks and rewards when you do so. Something we've seen a ton of examples of this week, CEOs coming out against Trump's decision to leave the Paris Climate Agreement. Countless other examples, it seems like, since January. One of which I wanted to ask Peter about to start off, which is that in February, UTA decided to cancel an Oscars party and instead hold a rally where people could speak out against controversial decisions that President Trump had been making on immigration. And I wanted to ask you, what was your calculus? Why did you decide to do it? What did you hope you would get out of it?
Well, the Oscars are a celebration of what my company does day in and day out. And so typically we do have a party, as do our competitors, which, if you really dig deep down, is a form of branding exercise, to use your terminology, because it represents who we are as a company and what we do, the way you put on a party. And one of our clients, Asghar Farhadi, had been an Iranian, had been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film for the Salesman. And he's been a longtime client, had been nominated for many other Academy Awards, won many awards. Wasn't coming, couldn't come. And so, giving credit to our CEO on a Sunday morning, we were deeply involved, engaged in the plans to do the party. He woke up on Sunday morning and said, "You know what, this is ridiculous. Why are we doing this? One of our important clients can't come. He can't come for all the wrong reasons. We're spending a ridiculous amount of money in celebration of something when in fact we should be giving that money to people who are protesting what he's not allowed to do, which is come to an event which to honor him." And so Jeremy walked into the office on Monday morning and called a board meeting and said, "This occurred to me yesterday," and we all said, "Wow, that's a really great idea." And we ended up having the rally, which of course also turns into a kind of branding exercise, because it really, I think, spoke in many ways to the way we as a company feel about what's, and many of our clients feel about what's going on in America right now. And it turned out to be a really fantastic thing in the sense that we raised a lot of money, which we gave away and I didn't have to go through the excruciating process of going to that Oscar party again.
are there risks when you decide to do something like that? You know, you've got thousands of clients. Some of them must be Republicans. You know, do you worry about alienating people? Or in a place like Hollywood that is so immigrant-friendly, is it riskier not to take a stand and not speak out on an issue like that?
I think in this particular instance, we were simply following our gut instincts and our conscience, if you will, and to the extent that we do represent people who support Trump, they are a harsh, harsh minority. I mean, I'll say it out loud, we do represent Bill O'Reilly. I just think we were doing what we thought was right. And so we didn't throw a feather up into the wind to see which way the wind was blowing. We just did what we felt was the right thing to do under the circumstances.
Okay, more broadly to the whole panel, how do you see that calculus of this day and age? You know, is it still really risky? If you take a stand on a political issue, are you potentially alienating clients, viewers, you know, investors, whoever it might be? Or is it riskier to stay on the sidelines when you need to be relevant, 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 and everyone cares so deeply about these pervasive issues?
I mean, I think it's less than being like one-sided as Republicans versus Democrats. It's really more about issues. So I know for our show, you know, something as natural as like fighting for women's rights. Like that's something that we really hasn't been threatened over the past couple years. So, you know, through the election campaign last year and debates, when that became a bigger and bigger issue and it started to become worrisome that many of, you know, the access to Planned Parenthood and, you know, other certain services that women are used to getting were threatened, then it was like, we can't not say anything. And whether you're a Republican or Democrat, like, you know, there's lots of Republicans that feel very strongly about women's rights and access to Planned Parenthood. So that was one of those things where we just gotta take a stand on the issue. We have to stand up and we have to support everybody else that's also rallying around this issue. And, you know, get involved in the Women's March, get involved in local marches, get involved with Planned Parenthood.
And where does that impetus come from? Is that, why do you have to do it? Is it because the world needs to know this is where Full Frontal with Samantha Bee stands? Is it because you have a platform and therefore an obligation? Is it because everybody's already weighing in and so you risk looking like you don't support it if you don't do it?
I think it comes to a boiling point. And for our show, it was during the third debate when Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton a nasty woman. And Sam was like, I can't fucking take it. Like, we have to do something. And I mean, that really started where she was like, I just want to wear a logoed Planned Parenthood t-shirt. And then we were like, well, how can we actually like get people involved and raise money for them and become a partner with them? Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's really, it's just from an organic passion that whether all of our viewers agree with it or not, we can't stand by. So we have to get involved.
So you're right that Republicans and Democrats both care about women's rights, but a third of Americans in one poll that I saw wouldn't like to see funding to Planned Parenthood cut. You know, did you get any blowback from that decision to be really out there and supportive of a politically divisive organization?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely, and especially in a day and age when we love it that we can have an interaction with our fans through social media and, you know, interaction with the public through social media, we got huge blowback from it. And especially the night of the election, you know, it was also a kind of a nasty time to be, to follow the hashtag Samantha Bee or, you know, Full Frontal. So that, we definitely feel it and we get it, but at the same time, you know, we feel like we have to do it.
Okay. Brad, at Funny or Die, DC, in a way your job is sort of to take a stand on behalf of clients that come to you sometimes, right? Tell me a little bit about, you know, in the audience, about, you know, what you weigh when a client comes and says, we would like a funny video to help us spread this message. You know, are there, for example, clients that you wouldn't take because you didn't feel their values lined up with Funny or Die?
Well, it helps. There aren't a lot of Republican groups that are banging down my door, I'll be very candid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Well, look, if Republican groups want to have a meeting, I'm happy to take it. I don't think that They really find our videos particularly funny, to be honest. You know, I come at it from a very different perspective. I served President Obama in the White House, and my job the past 4 years before this resistance energy and brands are taking stands was just trying to get anyone to take a stand. A lot of our job, and my job at Funny or Die, was trying to figure out a way to get groups more in the mainstream, right? They come to us because these groups don't know how to communicate, they don't know how to engage people, they don't know how to get people to call their member of Congress or sign a petition or vote, right? I mean, like, half our country doesn't vote. Something like 18% of young people vote in midterms. So, you know, a lot of my job is just trying to get people to take a stand. So I think that the fact that we're having this panel right now shows in a short amount of time how far we've come, because I think that it's exciting. It's exciting that, you know, that UTA did what they did. It's exciting that Sam, using her platform, is speaking out, because, you know, we can watch what happened today. We should all be alarmed what's happening with our democracy. We should all be alarmed. And so, you know, and we can show a little video, but this is, I feel like this is almost like the olden times of what I'm about to describe. But we pulled together a video of work I did at the White House of trying to do just this. How do we try to reach millions of people who are just not paying attention? And this was in the first year of enrollment for healthcare. If you guys remember, the website didn't work for 2 months, and that kind of sucked. And so we needed to figure out a way to, in a way, reintroduce healthcare.gov to the American public. Speaking of bad brands, it was like a really shitty brand at that moment. And the way that we did it was going to comedy experts, going to storytellers like those in this room, and people like Sam, people like Zach Galifianakis. We put together this video, and it was, not to be hyperbolic, but it was a bit of a game-changer moment for the White House and for the work that I do now.
That definitely makes it clear how effective it can be and how engaging it can be when brands do this work. I want to go to another big picture idea here, that consumers expect it too. There was one poll from Havas Worldwide that found that 70% of people expect businesses, companies, brands, to be driving positive social change just as much as the government. And Rajiv, I wanted to ask you about this because that impetus, the idea that companies must be values-driven, not just profits-driven, is especially strong among millennials and Gen Zers. You know, why are we seeing them look to brands and companies to be like, be my moral compass, you make the society a better place?
Yeah, within a context of the relationship between brands and political institutions, social values, activism, there's a bit of a spectrum. On one end, you have political institutions, cultural institutions, the state speaking to people as citizens, and then brands speaking to people as consumers. On the other end of that spectrum, often in lieu of strong confidence in the state, often in response to people feeling doubt about their institutions, brands often step into that power vacuum and speak to people as citizen consumers. They sort of overlap what they're providing in terms of communication, in terms of product, and in terms of some kind of offering. That's very common in developing markets where people don't have a lot of faith in the state or a lot of faith in institutions. And we see right now in the United States, especially driven by millennials and Gen Z, those factors, doubt about whether the state is actually going to provide for me, doubt whether traditional institutions are actually going to do their job, has people turning to brands in a big way. And we're really at a moment of transition within that spectrum. The result of which, however, is that that's a really fraught space as well. People are misstepping in a lot of ways and going into it a little bit headfirst without really thinking about where they have the cultural authority to speak. And that tends to be the big question about brands' interaction in this space.
Mm-hmm. There can definitely be a risk, you know, the kind of passion you describe, Kim, about like, we felt so strongly about this issue, you do it. Likely that will resonate with with people. There's a risk, of course, when you're a brand and you say, look, everybody's weighing in on this, we better take a stand. It can look disingenuous, can look like pandering. You know, what do you all think like about those missteps? How can you get it wrong? We can talk about the Pepsi ad, if you would like, as an example. I think that a lot of people said that was getting it wrong. You know, what are those risks and how do you avoid that?
I think the Pepsi ad was brilliant because it was so bad that we're still talking about Pepsi.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, I've never talked about Pepsi in like the past 10 years, and that's all people want to talk about is Pepsi. Yeah, I mean, look, it was really bad. I mean, there's no other word for it. It was almost, watching it, I thought it was a comedy video because it's like, how tone deaf can you possibly be? It almost would have been good if they like were honest about like, hey, we're trying to pander, you know, and being a little self-aware and irreverent. You know, look, I think that we do, as you guys saw in the video, we do corporate branding, branded entertainment all the time. I think we're, the one thing that I think brands need to think about when they're jumping into politics or a hot button issue is you can't like sugarcoat it. Mm-hmm. You can't bullshit. Like America's bullshit-o-meter, particularly like Gen Z and millennials, like they sniff it out like instantly. And so I think that, you know, it's not a surprise to me that the biggest, in my opinion, voices of the resistance are comedians. Because comedy is the voice of truth. It is the voice of truth to power. It is the last refuge of calling out power with truth. And if you bullshit with comedy, it's not funny. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a synergy. I mean, we've had very successful campaigns, but because I think comedy works so well, I think, you know, I would say to Pepsi, if there's any Pepsi CMOs, like, we would love to work with you. I think there's an opportunity to turn that misstep into something where you can start a conversation and you can bring people in and just be honest, man. Like, if you're good, like, you know, the stuff works with Sam because she's honest about it.
Exactly.
She's not pandering, she's not pretending to be who she isn't.
Yeah, and I mean, everything, like, nothing we do is arbitrary.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, whether, and that's down to, like, whether it's a cause we support, whether it's a story we cover, whether it's a field piece we do, even if it's a tweet we write, there is a lot of thought and there is a lot of background to that. So I think when brands and you know, especially poor Pepsi, like, like poor Pepsi, but I mean, they tried, but it was just bad in so many levels, badly produced. It just looked like a glossy version of, you know, a resistance protest, which if you've ever been in one or even seen footage, you know that is not how they look. Like, and there was just no passion there. And there was no truth. So
there seems to be other ways to go wrong too. That it's not as simple as, okay, I'm a brand. If I authentically believe it, then it'll work. One example is, do you all remember when Starbucks asked their baristas to talk about race relations in America? That happened when a ton of tension was going on, and it was not very well received. It was almost like consumers had reached a point where they say, I'll just have my latte and not the homily. Very much. Like, you know, but that seemed to hear, you know, the CEO talk about it, to have been authentic and a real thing and something they really cared about, rather than just trying to get attention. You know, we can land wherever on that.
But at the same time, when Starbucks came out about being supportive of Syrian refugees, it was so much better well received, because all they was just as simple, they took a stand and they were public about it. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a glossy campaign behind it. They just took a stand and they were public behind it. And I think they got a lot more consumers because of it.
And that's
You know, sometimes corporate America does get it right. I mean, I think the two of the biggest issues that facing America right now are climate change and healthcare.
Yeah.
And if you were to look at the at how corporate America, I mean, the biggest companies in America are dealing with those issues now, the stands they've taken on those issues now, the way they are commenting on Trump care, the way they are dealing with the Paris Climate Accord, I think you would find that the vast majority of them are on the quote-unquote right side of those issues, as opposed to the stupid people we elect to office. So how do you, I mean, how do you explain that? How do you deal with that? That's probably, is it just because they're better educated, or is it because they don't care about getting elected? They only care about, I mean, why does Exxon care about renewable energy, but the Secretary of Energy doesn't? I mean, what is that about?
Yeah, and I think if you look to these success stories and where corporate entities are really standing out, it's when they really know their place in culture and where they have authority to speak. And often that isn't a consumer-facing play. Sometimes it's about taking a step back and actually looking at your internal culture. So think Chobani, for example, that's used its hiring policies as a way of supporting refugees. It's also about understanding what conversations you might already be a part in. So Nike has really stood out in this case. Their recent equality campaign, they took a step back and saw that they are a dominant voice in the world of sports. And within the world of sports, there's a really ongoing conversation about race and gender. It's just endemic to that space. And so they really took that as an opportunity to see where they were already connected, where they had a platform and they had an audience, and use it in a way that felt organic, natural, and authentic above all else. So knowing where you fit in and what conversations you're already plugged into is a really great first step to success.
There can seem almost to be pressure to take a stand even when it's not necessarily a fundamental issue. For example, the NCAA and NBA saying they wouldn't go to North Carolina over a law that largely affected transgender people, which is not a central issue to them. But it seemed like there was so much support and so much pressure, that they felt like they had to speak out. Do you think that happens sometimes? Is that the world that we're in right now where brands might not want to do this, but in order to compete and keep appearances up, you know, they have to start taking more political stances?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that is a little bit of a reflection of Americans and citizens kind of waking up, right, and realizing that the activist power in our consumer buying habits, that you don't need to wear a pussy hat and stand outside in the cold. You can just sign a petition on Color of Change and get Bill O'Reilly yanked off of air, right? So there's a lot of, nothing against Bill, by the way. I love Bill and UTA. Sorry, just kidding. I don't love Bill. But no, I think that, you know, and yes, companies have to pay attention to it. I think that we live in a day and an age where that you will take a hit. Your stock price will take a hit. And that speaks to, I think, you know, this whole conversation, which is a lot of what you just said. You can't, particularly with Gen Z, it's like your identity is wrapped up in everything now, right? It's not just in the music you listen to, it's in the type of clothes you wear and the brand and the coffee you drink, and everything is who you are. And so the smart brands are realizing that. And to your point, it's a part of their purpose, it's a part of their culture, and it's a part of carving out a niche in the marketplace. Like, we're gonna occupy this, we're gonna be cool at it, and at the same time, we're going to be inspiring and uplifting communities that need it. And it's like, it's a win-win-win if you do it right.
Mm-hmm. And that would seem to speak to this idea of voting with your wallet, voting with your dollars, to, okay, well, if I feel like maybe my vote didn't matter as much as I wanted it to in the election, or I don't have faith in those institutions,
yeah,
then I actually feel like I can cover more ground. I can make more change with that. Rajiv, I want to ask you, too, about global markets.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about America, right? Perhaps lack of faith in these institutions, how people are acting here. How does this calculus change when it comes to other places around the world?
Yeah, it's actually quite helpful to contextualize the U.S. within a global context, because actually, especially in developing markets, this conversation is really developed. There's an expectation that brands step in for the failure of institutions. You have major multinational corporations really actually making that first step through social good, through efforts, especially in the environment, in local development, urban development. And a lot of that speaks to the fact that people have disinvested their sense of purpose from traditional institutions and are putting them within private entities like brands. And brands take on a lot of responsibility with that. What we're seeing in the US right now is a loss of faith in a lot of those traditional powers and traditional institutions, and a movement towards the private sphere. So when I go out and say I'm going to vote with my wallet, I really am taking that energy and taking that sense of citizenry and putting it in a completely new space. And brands need to sort of respond to that sense of authority that they have now.
Mm-hmm. How do you think social media has changed this landscape? You know, from the world where I was a company, maybe I put out a press release every couple weeks, to you're expected to respond to everything, right? And due to, like, you've got to be making puns about covfefe inside of a couple hours, you know, and if you're selling Belgian chocolates, you can't just keep tweeting about that if there is, you know, a political incident in Belgium that's affecting a lot of people. You know, in your jobs and your work, you know, how do you think social media has changed the landscape for when you take a stand and how you do it and whether you weigh in on these topics?
Well, I think it's shortened the time span between which you, I mean, I think you have to react rather immediately, and I think you have to stay on it. It's constant. It's like the 24-hour news cycle is now the 24-hour social media cycle, except it happens even quicker.
Yeah.
So, because there are more participants.
And consumers are really looking to make content and respond. One of the interesting things we saw with Pepsi, with Fire Festival, with all these other sort of these situations that sort of catch fire on the internet, they're really operating like memes in terms of the way that people are criticizing and responding. And they're operating through that impulse for consumers to create content and to really have an active voice within a larger conversation. So if you don't understand, say, the comedy space, say, the world of memes, you often can have the rug pulled from under you and really have that sense of pandering blasted across the internet. So
well, yeah, I mean, I do feel, I mean, one, we would have a different president without social media, and two, Pepsi wouldn't have been the Pepsi PR disaster without social media. Because, I mean, look, I see a bunch of shitty ads all the time. I mean, we all do, right? But it was exactly what you just described. It was everyone saw it instantly that day because everyone was tweeting about it and everyone was memeing it. And so the YouTube, I mean, it was something like 20 million views of this awful ad. It was like a train wreck that everyone had to see, which again, I think was kind of like brilliant in a weird way, because probably Pepsi got more brand recognition in that 24-hour period than they did in I don't know how many years combined. Granted, it was kind of bad, but so yeah, I think that the this relates to the world of politics, but it relates to everything. It's, you know, you can get on a flight and tweet something racist and then land somewhere 12 hours later and have lost your job and lost your girlfriend. Like, that's the power of social media. So there's, with great power comes great responsibility. Like, to your point, you can't be asleep at the wheel. Like, either you're going to be in it, you're going to engage your audience, you're going to be honest, or just don't do it. Just don't tweet. Don't use Facebook, because I think that the risk far outweighs the reward.
Right.
There's no taking it back.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Kim, you were speaking about when you backed Planned Parenthood as a show, plenty of backlash came to you through social media. You know, where do you land on how that affects whether you take a stand, you know, and how you engage with people, and how much you even pay attention to the positive and negative feedback you're getting through a portal like
but
that.
Can I ask a question? Wasn't the backlash great for the show?
Oh, we loved it.
Okay, that's what I mean. So you can characterize it as backlash, but it was like fantastic. I mean, nothing, it elevated Samantha's profile in the community.
Because it also proved the point. It proved the point that many people are like, oh yeah, you shouldn't be worried about that. Well, no, there's still a very vocal audience that is very against what we are for. So that just helped elevate and draw more attention to the issue and our support behind it. So I mean, yeah, I mean, our show's only on, you know, once a week. So we really rely on social media to, especially on Twitter. I mean, this morning with the Comey hearings, we had a show last night, but all of us were up bright and early this morning, ready to respond. But that's the trend. I mean, when you take a stand, whether it's a brand, whether it's a show, and your stand is, all right, we're going to hold our elected officials accountable, we also then have to be ready
to follow through
and to respond. And I think that's also something great you've seen with, like, journalists recently, too, even when they're, you know, they're able to respond so much quicker through Twitter and in Facebook even than they are able to, like, write and submit, you know, an article or even be on the air. So I think it's great.
I think we have to wrap up. Last question. Do you think that we are on a trajectory where eventually we'll just say, okay, businesses and brands, you shape public policy, and I'm not going to vote for a senator, I'm going to pay money to this company, and that's the way I'll vote. I mean, obviously, it won't go to those
You've
extremes.
Just described American politics. Not sure if you know, that's already happening.
But in terms of the brands and businesses themselves, you know, I can't sell you a pair of shoelaces unless I also am committed to urban footpaths. Like, is there going to be a point where it's oversaturation and people don't want brands and companies to be taking a stand and weighing into politics and being so involved, or is it just going to get more and more and more?
I think, well, look, I mean, I'm like two in the weeds on this because I live in Washington and I know how policy gets made. And it's from our companies. So, you know, I think that it's good. I think that it's good that it's a lot more public. I think it's also good that people are looking up and they're seeing how much money companies are giving to lobbyists to write legislation. And because there is a public face and then there's a private face. Mm-hmm. That is all being obliterated thanks to the internet and social media. So I'd much rather know. I'd much rather know where a company stands, to your point, you know, on climate change. And we're going to figure it out anyway.
Well, I think if Trump shoots someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue, that corporate America will actually respond in a positive way.
I think we need to make sure, and we as a community of marketers need to be engaged in how we're communicating with this, because what the Pepsi disaster sort of signals is the anxiety about the relationship between brand and values. There's a fear among consumers that it's going to be done badly, it's going to be done in a hollow way, and it's not going to reflect their interests. So as we're at this moment of transition where people are asking more of brands, it's about actually following through on action and making sure that there's lasting impact behind the types of issues, values we're committing to.
Great. Yeah, I think until we feel like our votes and our voices are being heard, like as many people that want to sell t-shirts that benefit Planned Parenthood, the more the better. Like, you know, the more that we're able to raise funds and awareness for important organizations, especially nonprofits that are out on the ground doing work, helping people that are really disadvantaged, then yeah, like let's do it.
You know, it would be really interesting to see which brands bought time on CNN this morning while Comey was testifying.
Yeah,
they got
yeah.
enormous numbers,
yeah.
and it would just be amazing to find out who Zucker sold time to and how much he charged.
Okay, well, when we come back next, we'll start with that. We'll reveal all the advertisers. Thanks to all the wonderful panelists for sharing with us. This was great.
Thank you.
Paige Albiniak is editorial director of Promax BEA. LaFern Cusack is executive producer of The Daily Brief podcast and senior producer at Promax BDA. Video helper provided the music. Digital producer Kate LaCaire-Marion and social media coordinator Christian Craik contribute to Daily Brief. Follow Paige on Twitter at Paige A, follow LaFern at LaFern Cusack, follow Promax BDA at Promax BDA. You can reach out to us at dailybrief@promaxbda.org. Subscribe to The Daily Brief podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.